This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. Michael Malice was the first guest on Unregistered, and after this interview, hopefully he won't be the last. Michael has been doing a lot of things since I talked to him last year, and I had a few bones to pick with him. So I sat down with him in New York, and we had it out. Here's what happened.
So Michael Malice is here.
Again.
Yeah, so Michael, you were my first.
It's true, I was gentle.
I wouldn't say that. I don't always like it gentle, though. That's why you were my first.
Okay.
Because I like an aggressive guest.
Okay.
Yeah, I like someone who's going to be strong with me.
Bite that pillow.
You know, yeah. And treat me with a firmness. Appreciate that.
The roughness you deserve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you were my first guest on Unregistered. And a lot has happened with you since then. It's less than a year.
I'm pregnant.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's about time.
Yeah.
The world needs another one of you. Everyone knows that. And so you've written a book. It's going to be published sometime this year, but you've written the manuscript.
Yeah.
With St. Martin's Press, major press. You have a verified Twitter account.
That was before.
No. Mm-mm. That was after.
I'm a
thousand. I'll bet you.
Within the last year I was verified, you're saying?
Well, I interviewed you in January of last year. The interview was in January.
Of 2017?
You got verified after that, yeah.
I will bet you.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, you have... No. Anyway, you have many
I
more...
I do have an Excel file.
You have way more followers. I remember that you and I were tied for followers.
No, you were ahead.
I was ahead, but
Trust
slightly. But
no, significantly, like 1 or 2,000.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and but now you have like twice as many or three times as many, right?
26.
You have 26, so you're almost twice
as
many. So you've gotten that's a lot. That's a big jump you've had since you were on my show. And you have a television show.
What's a web show?
It's TV. It's Compound Media. It's a video. It's like a TV. What's the difference? It's a video. It's a TV show.
You can't watch it on TV. That's the difference.
Well, you could. You can stream it through a television.
You're welcome.
It's a television show. It just happens to be on the web.
I feel like that's like when someone says I'm a writer and then they just have a diary. Do you know what I mean?
No,
you can't call it a TV show if there's not like a...
Does it look like a television show? Does it sound like a television show?
It looks like a public access
television. Does it quack like a television show?
There's no quacking in my studio.
Well, my point being, Michael, that you've had a hell of a year.
I have.
Since you were on my show.
Thanks to you.
And yeah, so I have one thing to say to you, which is this. You're welcome.
That's my welcome.
Because obviously that's all because of me.
It's partly because of you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Thanks.
Our audiences overlap.
I'll take some of that.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I contribute. No, I'd really. It's been impressive what you've been doing. So, yeah. How's it going?
It's going very well.
You wrote a book. Like, you hadn't even started the manuscript, right? When we had talked?
January 26, 2017, right?
Yeah.
I had not started the manuscript.
Yeah. So, in less than a year...
But I write a book in 6 months.
That's crazy.
I don't think it is. And here's the math.
You and I are exactly alike in that way, except only if you replace the word months with years, then we're exactly the
same. You do a fuck ton more research than I do.
I guess so.
And
that's my excuse anyway.
And well, you're an academic, so I think you're writing for more scholarly audience.
I have to have them in mind.
Right.
Yes, yeah.
And
I have to worry about them.
My point, if you write 3 pages a day, which is very, very, very reasonable, you'll have a book in 100 days.
It's reasonable if you have... How long does that take you to write 3 pages?
An hour.
What? Are you kidding? Seriously?
That's my stamina. Yeah, an hour. 3 pages an hour is unreasonable
to you? You can write 3 pages in an hour? I can't write 3... Of a book pages in
yes.
an hour? I could write 3 pages of a letter in an hour or an email in an hour.
3 pages.
Or hate mail. I could write that in an hour, but 3 pages of a book that's going to be published?
Yeah.
That's going to be...
That's like 750 words or 1,000 words.
Available to the public?
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
That's not fast.
Yeah, it is.
No, it's not.
Okay, fine. I mean, don't you have to think about what you're writing?
You think the other 23 hours of the day.
And you are doing research.
Of course.
Let's talk about what the book is. It's on...
Then you write.
Now. So that's mistake number one, I think.
Uh-huh. You know my quote, one of my tweets is unsolicited advice is never friendly.
You're the one who walked in
Let's hear it.
And said I was drinking the wrong protein
you were,
shake.
You were drinking muscle milk, which is terrible when you could be drinking Core Power.
Right, see, this is, and he's the one telling me that I'm being a patronizing.
I will never offer you advice again.
This has gotten off my to a
pecs,
bad start,
my
Michael.
My pecs are on point, motherfucker.
We're only 5 minutes in and we're already doing this. So why? I don't understand. Well, this is what people like. So anyway, yeah, he walks in. Well, no, before he walks in, I open my muscle milk. And the first thought I had, I swear to God, was Malice is going to say some shit about the muscle milk. He's going to say this is bad for me or something.
It is. And I'm not a health... I'm not
he walks in, looks at it and says, that's bad for you.
Yeah.
Where were we? Oh, you're...
I say you're drinking the wrong thing.
I'm drinking the wrong thing. That's how we start this fabulous conversation. So here's a mistake you made, which is worse than drinking the wrong protein shake.
Thinking you can take helpful advice.
You titled your book the wrong thing. You made the wrong... It's the wrong title. The New Right... is taken. That's an old title, an old label applied to a different movement than you're writing about, correct?
Correct.
Oh, okay. Wasn't that going to confuse the audience? Or is it just that they're so young, they won't even know what the New Right, the original New Right was?
Correct. They will not have references to 1980.
Do you want to call it the New Right then?
No.
The Neo New Right?
It's called the New Right.
And why not the Alt-Right? Because that's really what you're writing about.
It is not really what I'm writing about. The Alt-Right is a subset of the New Right.
All right. Keep going. What do you mean?
So the alt-right is the section of the New Right that believes that race is the primary or very close to most salient issue regarding politics.
That's the alt-right, according to you.
Yeah, and probably that's what they would self-identify as. Well.
Okay. So the race realists or race, what they call race realism is central to what you are calling the alt-right.
Yeah, I interviewed Jared Taylor. It was a hoot.
Fair enough. Yeah, who's not a huge fan of the Jews. Is that right?
Incorrect. So they hate him because he's solid on the Jews.
Oh, it's...
They look white to me. That was his quote on Donahue. What do you think about the Jews? They look white to me.
So he's a real scientist, huh? He really... That's how he determines one's race.
I broke it down for him because I asked him about that. I said, well, are you saying that we look white but we aren't, or that we look white and we are? And he was... So I didn't watch this interview, but apparently Richard Spencer had him on. They're having some debate, and Richard Spencer goes, isn't it true that like all of progressivism can be rooted in the Talmud? And Jared Taylor's like, no.
Yeah, they're funny when they get into this stuff. So Jared Taylor, just quickly, like he was an academic, right? He started out, didn't he start at like Yale or something?
Oh, I know he's got a Yale degree or whatever it is. And he was America's, one of the biggest Japanese English translators in the government for a long time.
I thought he was in sort of the academic establishment.
That's possible.
And then he left. Okay.
He's very erudite.
And he has, his books, I know what it was. I think his first book was actually considered to be respectable among academics.
Okay.
And I think it was within academic literature and considered, you know, it was like in the libraries and it was on syllabi and stuff like that, right? And he now, what's Jared Taylor's main argument? Like, what's his thing? What does he do? What's he known for?
American Renaissance is his website.
Right.
And he's the big one saying, we need to have a frank, open discussion about racial issues in the West.
Mm-hmm. And what does he want to say about racial issues in the West?
He thinks if people were allowed to self-segregate based on race, that would make society function a lot easier.
Hmm. Why is that?
Because that's just our natural inclination. Like, when you force... interactions with people who shouldn't be interacting with each other, it's going to cause conflict. And also his big point is there's a lot of things about like black people that the media covers up and therefore the basic discussion is inherently dishonest.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of dishonesty. I agree with him there. Sure. So the presupposition is that people within a race, as he defines it, tend to get along better than people between races.
But he also doesn't bite the bullet when I'm like, what about the Civil War?
But is that right, though? That's what he's going on?
Yes.
That's the assumption here.
That's a big one.
Is that white people will tend to get along better, be more harmonious, socially cohesive than...
That's the term, yeah.
people of different races.
Heterogeneous. And especially really? If it's in a country, because then the country is doomed to kind of collapse.
Yeah. And then so the evidence for that, I'm just scanning history right here in my mind here. Let me think. Thinking back. Have any white people ever killed other white people, like in large numbers?
But his whole point is they can communicate better with each other.
Oh, while they're dropping bombs on Hamburg and Berlin, really?
Listen.
Hello down there, Germans. This is the Americans. We're white just like you. Remember, this is, we're doing it for your own good.
Well, I'm not an ethnostate person. Although I'm glad.
Oh, I'm not arguing with you.
I'm glad. I don't think it's
not
fair.
Yet.
I don't think it's fair to argue with him when he's not here, because that's a cheap shot.
Okay. Well, okay. Fine.
I'm sure Jared Taylor is perfectly aware of World War II and would be able to address that very obviously.
You think so? You think he's heard of World War II?
He's very bright.
I'll have to have him on the show to find out if he's ever heard of that.
He's amenable.
Conflict back in the
1940s. No, he talks about that. He goes, look,
I'm kidding.
Basic nature of element of our nature, our dark nature. And
yeah, I kind of want to talk to these guys, but it's really only a curiosity because they're pretty powerless and insignificant, I think. Maybe you disagree because you've studied them.
God forbid you talk to powerless people, Thad.
Powerless. Oh. Okay, I'll give you that point. You win one today. Well, let's see.
Some core power.
Well, let's see. Wait, no, I guess I'm not interested in intellectuals whose arguments I think are ridiculous and who have no significant, I think, following, like really following, right? So I'm interested in people, certainly people I'm interested who I totally disagree with, who are powerful intellectually and culturally, but those guys aren't. Right, do you think?
I think it's a bell curve. In any population, you're going to have distribution.
Well, so tell me, like, how powerful? What's the clout? Is it clout? Yeah, K-L-O-U-T. Like, well, in culture, what would his cultural clout score
what
be?
What I think is interesting about Jared Taylor specifically is, my understanding is, his video was the first one demonetized by YouTube.
Was it?
Yes, on Race and IQ. And he and Amran, were both kicked off Twitter.
Yeah, those guys are obsessed with IQ. They just can't stop talking about IQ and racial differences about IQ.
Right. And my point is you will always have stupid people in any population.
Like, what do they want to do with that information? Even if it was true, what they think about IQ and race.
Listen.
Where are they going with this? That's the thing.
You'd have to talk to them.
But you did. You have. That's all you've been doing for the last year. So tell us, what did they say?
Well, I mean, I don't feel that I can. I hate when, what was that girl's name who's interviewing Jordan Peterson in Britain, that dumb woman?
On Channel 4?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to be the guy paraphrasing what Jared Taylor says and making him look inarticulate.
Excuse me, I thought you were writing a book about him.
Right.
And so, then are you going to not report what they said in the book?
It is in a book. I can sit and think and present it fairly and accurately off the cuff without reference to my notes. I'm not going to do him justice.
You're not going to summarize what you believe to be his arguments here? You're not going to do that?
I don't think that I think his point is low IQ is going to lead to things like criminality. And at a certain point, if you're taking low IQ people and putting them in high IQ situations like universities, there's that mismatch is going to cause a problem. The thing is, I'm not always sure which arguments are his and which are some other people's. And again, in the book, I interview him, so it's direct quotes.
But what has he said about these things? Does he just want to lay out what he believes is the fact of
that
racial differences on IQ? Or does he just leave it there? Because a lot of people do.
I am not going to be Jared Taylor's spokesman. I'm not good at it. I don't think Jared Taylor is that. He's been writing with this for 30 years.
I thought for sure you were writing a book about him.
I'm not writing a book about him. I'm writing a book about a movement of which he's one figure.
Can I ask you what your speculative guess is as to what he would like to see in terms of the organization of society?
I know exactly what he would like to see, which is, first of all, he makes the point that you can't just have a right-wing culture, that you need, like he talks about, my mother was a socialist and she was a proud socialist, but she was a proud Southerner as well.
Oh, wow.
So this idea that you're just going to have these Southern secessionists who are pro-small government, pro-religion, that's not what makes a nation. So he has a much more nuanced view of cohesiveness than white Republicans.
But he also sounds like a large nation state.
I don't know how big it has to be.
But bigger than the Confederacy, apparently.
I don't know that that's necessarily true.
Okay.
Because when he talks about like Europe.
But he wants a separate white nation state.
An
ethno-state.
Is this right? But he also wants he's kind of like soft on the borders. So he's like, I'm not going to, if someone wants to say they're white and they're peaceful, fine.
What?
I know.
That's how your race is determined, by what you say it is?
Ask him.
Oh boy, he's a Foucauldian French postmodernist relativist.
He's subjectivist.
He believes truth is subjective, apparently.
You're the subjectivist.
No, he sounds like he is. If saying you're white makes you white, that makes you a subjectivist. If that's what you believe, he would agree with Foucault there.
I would enormously resent if someone were sitting in this room and trying to ascribe my arguments and defend them when they didn't agree with me secondhand. And I keep saying
Stop doing this, man. You're going to be... So first of all, when the book is published, you're going to do a lot of media, right? You're going to do all these interviews about the book, and they're going to ask you exactly what I'm asking you now. Why are you reticent? Why are you afraid to do this? They're going to say, so what do these people argue? What do they believe? What do they believe
There's
in, Michael Malice?
There's a difference between what do these people believe and what does Jared Taylor specifically want for the future and how big the ethnocide
I'm asking
is going
you to be. I'm asking you to make a very educated guess.
I think that's tacky to do when I am
okay.
When I'm talking about people who many of whom regard me as their natural enemy because I'm Jewish.
Okay,
so
right.
So again, if I get something inaccurate and imprecise, then it's me being shifty and shady, right? So that I want to speak very carefully and precisely about this issue. Okay. You can laugh all you want.
Okay.
If it's North Korea, I can talk about this inside and out. Jared Taylor, I don't know his soul to the extent I know North Korea. I talked to him for 2 hours and that was enough to get what I needed for my book.
Okay. So
it's not a deep dive.
He does talk a lot about race and IQ.
Very much
okay.
so.
He
yes.
believes that there is fundamental biological differences among the races
Correct.
On IQ, that
Correct.
People of certain races have lower IQs than people of other races.
If you look at the ancient historians, they came to the same conclusions we did,
and
that they were not as intelligent
now,
and had hypersexed and had greater rhythm.
Now, if you define the races of the world the way that Americans currently define the races of the world,
right.
and you accept IQ as a valid measurement of intelligence, then he's of course correct. That's just indisputable that the tests taken, the scores of what we call black people are lower on average than the scores of what we call white people. So there's no doubt about that.
Okay.
Now, he's also completely correct in arguing that there's tremendous dishonesty on the left about that simple fact, which in our world, the way we apprehend the world, the way we think about the world, that is a fact. Within Western culture and all the rules that we play by, that is a fact. You agree with that, don't
sure.
you? Sure. Yeah, okay. Then the more interesting and important questions arise, and I don't think he's ever dealt with those. Did you make him deal with the questions of what is a race? Who is white? Why are they white?
No.
Oh. Okay. But you announced yourself as a Jew, didn't you? Did you tell him?
Oh, yeah. I picked his brain heavily about the Jewish question because I was very interested.
And you told him that you're Jewish?
Yes.
And what did he say to that?
Get out of my house and into my oven.
Uh-huh.
No, he made the point. He goes, look, Jews are very heavily overrepresented in these anti-white movements.
Mm-hmm.
That said, the idea that Jews aren't white or that every Jew is my enemy is nonsense.
Nonsense. So is he aware? Do you know if he's aware that Jews were once considered to be Negro?
I don't know. I'm pretty sure I recommended your book to him.
I'm sure he didn't know this, did he?
I didn't ask. I don't. That was a question.
That's the first thing I would say to him. I said, do you think the Jews have always been considered white by scientists?
Right.
Because they weren't.
Right. As you and I discussed, a race is just an ethnicity is a race that you approve of.
Well, no. According to pretty much every scientist who studied this, Jews were black until World War II.
I don't think we...
That was a consensus.
I know that book, that pamphlet you had, The Jew and Negro,
mm-hmm.
which I think was some self-published... I don't think it was a mainstream publication, to say the least.
Yeah, Arthur Abernathy, who was the author of that, was a major journalist of the time. He was like the Andrew Sullivan of the 1910s.
Was he?
Yeah, sure. But that was just representative. There's extensive literature on this. It's not just me. By the 30s, yes, there starts to be some questioning of this, but really only among like a really small portion of the academic left at Columbia around Franz Boas, who was the anthropologist
right.
who was Jewish.
Zora Neale Hurston.
Exactly. Ruth Benedict, Margaret Mead, they started to question this because their man, Franz Boas, was Jewish. And so it's like, what do you mean they're inferior race? No, we're all Caucasian, including the Jews, the Caucasian race.
Well, you could be an inferior race enough to be a Negro.
Was invented by them at that time. And so to basically justify going to war. That's what it was used for. So they invent the idea of a Caucasian race had been invented previously, but it wasn't a mainstream idea until World War II. And then they invented this thing because it's like, well, first of all, we've got to get the Italians to fight with us. We've got to get the Jews to fight with us. We've got to get all these people, all these ethnics, these racial inferiors to fight with us. We also have to explain why we're going over there to fight those people. Well, they're racist. So it's going to be the Caucasians all together fighting to save the Jews, to save our own people.
Right.
That's when Jews became Caucasians. Total invention at the time. So it was almost a consensus until the 30s. Pretty much it was a consensus among like social scientists and scientists that Jews were a separate race than whites.
Right, but not Negro.
That was probably a majority claim that they were of the Negro race, or at least much closer to the Negro race than to the white race.
Okay, yes. Right, but we were our own thing was the idea.
Yeah,
right. Okay.
But it was a common argument that they were essentially Jews were Negroid.
Okay.
Yeah, and which
with the hair.
If you look at the map, I mean, it's not the total most irrational thing because they just came. They had come most recently from that part of the world.
We were criminals.
And jazz singers, yes, and criminals and gangsters and
vaudeville,
yep,
lowlifes,
comedians.
Yep. Yeah.
Right. So you found that out from Jared. You went to his house?
Yeah. In Virginia.
So is it like a James Bond villain's mansion?
No.
Of course
he
not.
Has yeah, Confederate money on the wall. Framed Confederate money. And he also has a lot, because he grew up in Japan. So he has lots of like Japanese artifacts and like cases that were very beautiful.
Yeah, the Japanese thing is interesting to me. I knew that about him. He was raised in Japan. Why? Who were his parents?
I don't know. That's off the top of my head.
I think that's actually important. I mean, he never really lived in America when he was growing up. And he sort of saw it from a remove. And I think that accounts for the accent, which he probably partly gets from his mother, but it's also sort of an English affect. And it's kind of like this ethereal above it all pose, I think, for him.
I don't think that's true at all. I don't think he's pompous. He was very down
to earth. No, I don't mean it's deliberate. Like, I don't think it's pretentious. I just think it's like he's got this identity that's very odd, right?
Because
he's an outsider, and he's looking from outside.
He's a character.
At all of America, right?
He's very much a character.
Yeah, he's a character, yeah. White
people. Jim Goad, who I believe was on your show, mm-hmm, a good buddy of mine, mm-hmm, he did a clip of just Jared Taylor, white people, white supremacy, white belly dancers, white people. Yeah.
And he interviewed him too.
Yeah, yeah.
So how much of a following does he have?
Jared Taylor?
Yeah.
See, this is where I disagree with the corporate press, and that's a very common question. Mm. Because if you look at Trotsky and Lenin, if you look at the founding fathers, I'm very much in agreement with James Burnham that it's always a number of the elites and a circulation of the elites, and the masses are never going to have ideas or thoughts of their own.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, whether it's a hundred.
Well, not never, but they tend not to.
I would say never.
What? What do you mean never? They never, of course they have thoughts.
I would say they never have thoughts.
What?
That they're incapable of thought.
Who's the masses then?
Anyone who's not in the elite.
Okay.
Anyone who's not verified on Facebook.
This would be circular
logic.
Are you
verified on Twitter? Are you verified on Twitter?
Right. Therefore, I have no thoughts.
You're not.
No,
right?
I'm not verified. Therefore, I have no thoughts.
QED.
Yeah, no thoughts. That's good.
That's why you're in academia.
That's good. Okay.
Where the thoughtless belong.
Now we're clear.
Okay. I'll try to dumb it down for you.
I think I agree with your major point here, though. Right? That the great sort of political movements, social formations, the great major decisions in history, right, that have determined the shape of the world and all that. Yeah. Oh, of course, almost entirely elites and their ideas, a very small number of people.
So the idea is basically, and this is James Burnham again, me and Mencius Bullbug, who some of your listeners know, we both independently came to what's the most important book, and it's James Burnham's book, The Machiavellians.
Huh.
So the point of the circulation of the elites is, even in the most democratic process, which would be like a town hall, you still have to have that guy at the front of the room delineating debate, what questions will be asked, mm-hmm, how long you can talk for. So even in that scenario, you have some sort of elite control. So the idea of democratic rule is impossible even in theory.
Mm-hmm. I guess. I don't see why the masses can't have their own thoughts or even sophisticated thoughts. I don't see why it's impossible. They tend not to. I agree with that.
I think if something tends to happen universally, that there must be some kind of and throughout time, there must be some kind of basis somewhere.
Is this the way you sneak in your Jewish supremacy thing? Like, this is how
I read
this.
David,
is I convinced the Gentiles that you should run, that you should run the stuff.
Oh, I shouldn't be running shit.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm an anarchist.
Oh, you should not be running shit.
No.
Okay.
No one should be running.
Right. Why are you writing books then?
For the lulz.
No.
Why do anything?
Really? Is that it?
No. But I mean, why does a troll do anything for the lulz? No, to be honest, I'm writing this book because I've been in this scene since its inception, because a lot of my anarchist friends became deviationists, so to speak. And I'm like, someone's going to write this book and it might as well be me. And I might as well be a Jewish immigrant talking about this stuff on the air because I will be able to do it fairly and I'm not going to be myself vilified like, oh my God, he's just another cishet white male, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Do you remember the first time we met in person?
Was that in LA?
The lunch we had in LA. Yeah. That was like several years ago.
Yeah.
And I remember you mentioned Mencius Moldbug.
Yeah.
What's his online name?
That is his online name.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Curtis Yarvin.
That's how dumb I am.
Curtis Yarvin is his real name.
Okay. Yeah. And you mentioned him in NRX. Is that what it's called?
NRX. Any Reaction.
So this was about, just to be fair to myself here, I'm not that bad. This was a good 4 years ago, right?
Something
like that. Yeah. So it was before the alt-right was really known.
Correct.
And so I didn't know anything. And you assumed that I did know.
Yeah.
And when I said, who's that? I remember the look on your face was like, what? How do you not know? What do you mean?
I thought you of all people.
You actually said, are you kidding me?
Right.
Are you joking?
Did I really?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And I was like, what? Should I be offended now? So they were kind of the original alt-right in a way. Is that right? The Mencius, I've known nothing really about
them. So Mencius Moldbug is the founder of what he calls neo-reaction. So he is the one who really popularized, I don't know if he coined the term per se, the idea of the red pill. Mm-hmm. The idea that what we're presented in the press is a carefully constructed facade. And that one, it's like the metaphor is like two fish are coming across each other in the river. And one says, hey, the water's great today. And the other fish goes, what's water? So it's like when you are raised in a certain ideology, you are oblivious to it. Mm-hmm. So neo-reaction started the whole idea of deconstructing progressivism. You know, they very much talk about race being a social construct. Well, this is like our socioeconomic background is a very heavily and for decades social construct. Mm-hmm. And once you're aware of how it operates, which has been collapsing in the last 3 years, and I can't believe that quickly, then all sorts of other dominoes start falling.
Okay. So he had
a blog on Blogspot, Righteous Observations, and he writes very, very, very long-winded, but very, very bright. And this really sparked this whole scene.
Okay. So I actually love that metaphor, the Matrix metaphor, the fish metaphor, you know, swimming in water and not realizing you're in water.
Right.
And the red pill, you know, suddenly, for whatever reason, seeing that you're swimming in water,
right?
That you're surrounded by this thing you weren't even aware of before.
Right.
I love that. I think that's apt for a lot of stuff. Now, here's the thing. Once again, that's essentially what Foucault and the postmodernists were doing too in the beginning in the 60s and 70s. They were saying this, that we all live in these constructs. And the problem is in the modern era, no one was aware that they were living in constructs, right? They just had all these assumptions about what the world was. It was like the Truman Show, the dome. Everybody lived in that dome and it was like a TV show, but the people living there,
I think this is kind of the opposite.
In a dome.
Because I think with Foucault, I'm not familiar with Foucault, but I know that as my girl Camille Paglia, like he's the great villain. I think with Moldbug, his point is this is consciously constructed over decades and intentionally. I think Foucault says this is a function of the system and even the proponents of it are not aware that they're doing it. Is that not correct?
Yeah.
So that's the big difference.
Well, there's another big difference I was getting to actually. But I still think that the two theories function somewhat.
Probably.
They're similar.
There's deconstruction in both. Like what we're seeing, dig deeper than what you're told at face value. That's
it's
true.
Like people are playing it. The other analogy I use or metaphor I use is like playing a game, right? We're playing a game. We play Monopoly, but most people don't know they're playing a game. They think that Monopoly is the end of reality, that it ends at...
Right. Correct.
Right? There is no reality outside of it. The Truman Show, the movie, I don't know if you remember.
Yeah, of
course. Everybody lives in a dome. It's a glass dome or an invisible dome, but they don't know that there's another reality outside of it.
I got to give you a shout out to my friend Mary Pallon, whose book called The Something Show comes out next month, because there's something called Truman Show Syndrome. Have you familiar with this?
No.
So Truman Show Syndrome is a mental illness where you believe that you're in a reality show and all your friends are actors. and you laugh, but it's actually profoundly disturbing.
Wow, yeah.
And
this is the thing. This is happening.
Yeah, this has happened to some people. And it turns out one of the people who had this, I think it's called I'm sorry, Mary, I forgot the name of the book. One of the people who had this was an Olympian.
Hmm.
So she met him and interviewed him. And this is all about this mental illness.
Hmm.
It's fascinating.
I'm not even sure how to classify that. Where to fit that in intellectual history. So the alt-right, you know, and that's kind of why I like that. I like that part of them.
I don't think Moldbug would call himself alt-right.
But would you not? put him in?
No, I would not.
Oh boy, here we go.
Because he's not, like, again, race for him is not the primary or most salient issue.
No. But the red pill and the cathedral is their other.
That's
metaphor.
His concept.
Yeah.
Which he came up with that concept.
And that doesn't unite the people you're talking about here, alt-right people. They think that most Americans, most people in the West have this whole set of ideas, assumptions about the world and how it's organized and morality that is simply a set of social constructs.
Well, the cathedral is,
and that there's another way of thinking about everything.
The cathedral is more the actual system mechanism that promulgates these ideas. Yeah. But the idea, again, what unites this whole scene is a repudiation of progressivism. Mm-hmm. It is not a consensus on race and the importance of racial issues at all.
The water that the fish swim in.
Right.
The cathedral.
Right.
Those are progressivism for these guys.
Correct.
Yeah. It just so happens that progressivism, according to them and according to me, I agree with them on this, has been the dominant ideology, way of thinking, dominant culture in the West for about 150 years.
Right.
And that's what they're saying, right?
Correct. And okay. Also, here's a great way for
even among so-called conservatives, that they essentially have progressive assumptions and operate within progressive rules, don't they?
As I always say, and you fuckers better give me credit when you quote me, conservatism is progressivism driving the speed limit. Right. My point is, yes. Yeah, so if you look at World War II, mm-hmm. here's a great example of red pilling. If you look at World War II, we're told it's the good guys.
There you go.
Versus the fascists and the Nazis.
There you go.
Whereas the red pill approach is you had three rival gangs, mm-hmm. progressivism, communism, and Nazism,
yep.
and progressivism won and conquered the world.
That's right. Completely correct.
Yes.
I mean, that is one way in which I view it. Yes.
And Moldbug has this other great point, which I have to give him credit for. It goes, if you look at World War II and the Nazis and the commies, shouldn't I be more worried about the bad guy that stayed around than the one who was killed?
Right. So the cathedral / progressive view, the dominant view, and this is for conservatives and lefties, you're saying,
right,
is that World War II was simply the victory of the good.
Right.
Over the bad.
Right. And I don't know how Stalin fits into this, but we don't talk about it.
It's just, yeah, he's left out.
Yeah, he's like, well, that's an asterisk.
It's just good.
Yeah.
They don't even break it down much beyond that.
Right,
like, correct. What's good about it, except that the Nazis, it's good because the Nazis are bad.
And then if you criticize it, it's like, what, you want the Holocaust to happen?
Right.
QED.
Why are you a fascist?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so I, of course, love all that, right? That's very similar to much of my thinking.
Yes,
very
of course.
Sympathetic to that.
I always say your book is one of the five books that every new right person should read.
Oh, boy.
And your book is what...
Well, should read, yes.
Yes, your book is what I tore Jared Taylor apart with.
Oh, how... Oh, do tell. What do you mean?
You're going to have to wait for my book to see.
Oh, no!
I'm not spoiling it. This was the big climax. I'll tell you off air.
Michael.
I'm not blowing my load on your listeners.
Such
Sorry,
a tease.
Guys.
You were my first, and now you're just a tease.
This episode is sponsored by Renegade University. There's no question that, as a culture, we have grown increasingly frank and open about sex and sexuality. But a strange thing remains. Fiction writers, especially people considered to be serious fiction writers, those people who write novels that are reviewed in the New York Times, tend not to talk about or describe in real detail actual sex. They're afraid of it. The oldest, greatest taboo in Western culture still is quite powerful, apparently, among fiction writers. But there are some writers who do it, and do it very well. They use descriptions of sex to craft some of the best short stories and novels in American literature. We're very fortunate to have one of those writers teach a course at Renegade University. Rebecca Schiff was a guest on Unregistered last year, and she'll be teaching a course, a craft seminar, on writing sex. There will be three class meetings beginning on March 28th at 8:30 p.m. Pacific and 10:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Rebecca will show how some of the very best writers in American literature have used sex to develop characters and storylines. In the class, students will read stories that face sex head-on and explore how contemporary writers, in particular, use sex to create compelling fiction. Rebecca is the author of the acclaimed collection of short stories, The Bed Moved, which was a finalist for an LA Times Book Prize for first fiction. She is considered to be one of the most honest and brave fiction writers who write directly about sex. The course is limited to 15 students, so it may sell out soon. To register for the Writing Sex Craft Seminar with Rebecca Schiff, go to ThaddeusRussell.com/courses.
No, fine, I will. I'll answer you. Your point, which I think is so profound, and only as I'm speaking now am I realizing how much it dovetails with Camille Paglia, who's one of my biggest ever influences, is the idea of the extreme importance of low culture in moving societies.
Right. Yeah.
And he, Jarrett Taylor,
had no idea.
The idea of that,
bizarre idea to him.
It wasn't bizarre. He's not dumb, but it was more like he'd never heard that before.
And how could that be? Because he's very much an elitist, like an old school aristocratic. That's really, I was talking about his identity. He's aristocratic in his identity.
But I don't think he'd call it elitist in that he has like disdain for the masses.
I mean, he has a goddamn British accent and he's an American, you know? I mean, it's weird. That's aristocratic. That's putting on aristocratic airs, isn't it?
I don't think it's putting on airs. That makes him sound like a phony.
Well, how do you talk like that? How do you learn that?
I mean, you can't choose how you talk. Huh? His accent. That's not a fake accent.
Well, where would he have heard that?
I'm sure he grew up in lots of different places. You think his accent is affected? That's a big accusation.
He grew up in Japan. So if he'd grown up in Hong Kong, okay. Maybe there's a British school in Japan where he went to school.
You can look it up on Wikipedia right now.
If he'd gone to Hong, if he's in Hong Kong, sure, that's where you can get a British accent from. But Japan, I don't know. As far as I know, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I don't think that's a common thing.
I do not think that his accent's fake.
I don't think there are a lot of English speakers in Japan who speak like that.
I would bet money that his accent is some kind of amalgam of a few different accents somehow.
Whatever. It doesn't matter. I don't care.
It does matter because you're calling him a phony.
Nah. No. That's what I don't want to do. I don't care. I mean, I want to take him at his word and I want to deal with his ideas.
Yeah.
So I take that back.
I love his accent.
I'm sorry, Jared. Oh, I think it's funny as hell. Yeah. Oh, I don't care. I just think it's funny and interesting. But I also think it actually may play a part in the overall politics. I'm not exactly sure how, but there is... Well, I mean, he's constructing the white race as the elite race, right?
He's not a white supremacist. He's a white nationalist.
Because he thinks the Asians are smarter, right?
Yeah.
Their out from that.
I want every race to be happy with their own kind. So he's not making a moral judgment in that sense of some kind of hierarchy.
But you said his major argument is that blacks are less intelligent.
It doesn't make them inferior. That makes them different, I think you could say.
Really?
Well,
doesn't he think intelligence is a good thing?
Well, I know he would repudiate the term white supremacy.
Oh, okay. And what I'm saying is the logic of his argument adds up to absolute white supremacy. I don't see how else.
A white country, yeah.
Yeah.
Every country has to have something supreme.
He thinks intelligence is good. And he thinks that blacks have less of it. How is that not white supremacist?
Well, again, the Asians are smarter than the whites, according to him. And the Jews are smarter than the non-white Jews.
Okay. Oh, does he say that? Because Jews have a higher IQ?
Of course.
But, you know, he agrees with that?
Of course.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, good for him. Yeah, so, and he wants an ethnostate, right?
Correct.
Okay, a separate white ethnostate.
Correct.
Does he want the other peoples to have their own ethnostate?
Yes, very much.
Who does?
Be happy, but be happy with your own kind.
And he promises to leave them alone?
Oh, absolutely.
Does he say how he would bring that about? How would he?
I think the first step is what he's doing is education. He's not a war hawk at all. Yeah, he's very much a man of, he would say a man of peace, I'm sure.
But there's a whole lot of intermingling, and you're going to have to do some separation of lots of human beings. So how are you going to do that?
I think the point is, if you have like 80% whites, and then you have, like when he was in Japan, right? He's not saying, kick me out of Japan, but he's saying, I'm in Japan, I'm Jared Taylor, I'm white, know my place.
Know my place. Oh, yeah. So he's not talking about a physically separate ethnostate.
I think it is physically separate to an extent, but it's not literally 100% pure.
Okay. So the Nation of Islam... Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X, that their argument was, their project was to establish not a separate physical black nation, but to have black institutions basically within the United States that were independent and autonomous.
Look at the spaceship that they built.
Now, right. So I'm just asking, is that Taylor's vision?
No, he wants
whites?
A physical.
He does want.
Physical space, yes. But that said, it's not going to be some like papers, please, absolutist area.
Oh, so he will allow immigration into the white ethnostate?
I don't. I'm sure there'll be some limited, immigration.
Okay. If he didn't spell it out, tell me that. I'm just wondering.
No, he did, but I'm sure a lot of this is haggling at a certain point. I mean, the point is like, listen, if it's going to be 80 or 90%, I'm sure, you know what I mean? At that point, it's kind of irrelevant.
Okay. How does he define white? Who's white and who's not?
I think I didn't get into that with him.
Mm-hmm. So everyone... of, quote, European origin?
I think he would say, yeah.
Including,
and Slavs.
Including Slavs and Jews and all these people.
Jews are white. He flat out said it.
Including people and Greeks and Italians?
Yes.
Wow. Sicilians?
I know, right?
Does he go that far?
They're practically apes.
Well, they were, according to scientists, not very long ago.
According to vision. You can just look at them.
Wow. So we're Jews, by the way. Jews were considered monkeys too.
Apes are not monkeys.
More the Irish and Italians were.
Apes are not monkeys.
Called that. The
There's
Jews
a big difference.
Were more often associated with Negroes, but okay. So that's funny though, right? That they're very. I've heard Richard Spencer say this too. Like he's really loose about his. He says this. He's I'm sort of loose about who's white and who's not. I'm like, well, then what the hell is this?
So here's the thing: when you talk to them,
it sounds not terribly coherent.
None of the prominent ones are really white supremacists. And they all really think it's a dumb.
No, but they're separatists.
Right.
Okay. So then, who gets separated from whom? And they're very loose about that. And I find that bizarre. If your whole thing is race and race differences, that's what everything rests on. Is their
sure.
their belief that there are fundamental biological differences?
But they're not utopians
among races. And so then, if you're like, well, okay, the Portuguese are white too, and the Jews are white too, and the Slavs and the Finns and the Irish.
I'm sure at a certain point, language then, plays a big part.
What about Persians?
So they should be in Iran.
So the Aryan, the so-called Aryan race, the theory there is that the Aryan race stretches for some reason from Germany, I think actually Scandinavia, through Germany and all the way down to Iran, Iran, right? So a lot of Persians consider themselves and have considered themselves to be Aryan, the same race as Adolf Hitler. Do they count in Richard Spencer's ethnostate?
Okay, I'm not speaking. Here's the thing. You are very familiar with the paper bag test. So the paper bag test.
Oh, the brown.
Yeah, paper bag test used to be for these black cultural groups. If you were darker than a paper bag, you couldn't join.
Right.
They had some arbitrary line about, and you had colorism. This is still a concern in black communities.
Colorism,
right.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Things like, are Persians allowed in the ethnostate? I am confident that there is not a huge consensus in these circles about the Persians. And I'm sure this is like, okay, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Mm. Let's worry about getting everyone more or less like colored like us.
Yeah, but more or less when it comes to saying that.
But it's like marginal cost and marginal benefit, Dad, right? The marginal cost is like at a certain point, do you really want to be going through and looking through attics? At the very least, it's expensive.
It doesn't make sense. It's contradictory. If your project is racialist,
right,
which it is in
yes,
this case.
Absolutely.
Then you have to police those categories carefully,
or not to some extent,
because
you don't
have
to police it.
Wait a minute.
If you have the population who believes in this, it's self-policing.
So if the Nazis found out that you had one relative who was Jewish,
but they're not Nazis,
you were removed from their society.
But these right, physically removed. Right?
I know. I'm not saying they're Nazis. I'm saying the Nazis were Nazis. They were also racial separatists.
Correct.
So that is the overlap, and they would agree
Correct.
With me on this.
Correct.
So they're racial separatists. Okay, so the Nazis were really clear about this. At least it was logically coherent. If there's an inferior gene that's attached to a race, right, or associated with a race, then you've got to keep that out of your society, or else it's going to go to hell again.
No, I mean,
you got to be careful about policing this stuff. That's what the Nazis were about.
There's a difference between being careful and being an absolutist.
And the eugenicists, the same thing in this country, right? They were like, we've got to find out which races have inferior genes, and we got to track those genes. And anybody who has a gene from an inferior race, even if they're as white as a sheet, need to be sterilized.
But the, I mean, I think that's a slippery slope that they're not always going to go down. For example, like Tay-Sachs.
I'm saying they're not very good at being racists.
Okay. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
I mean, that was 90% serious and 10% a joke. Okay. I really, seriously. And I wonder what that means. You get my point, though. Don't you think they're way less rigorous than racists of the past?
I think, no. Sure. But what I'm saying is I don't think they have the clout that racists of the past did. And I think this is kind of like baby steps. Like, okay, let's throw this out there. Once we get this locked down, we could start solidifying our gains.
Oh.
So it's a strategic issue.
So this is strategic, and they're packaging. They're trying to make their ideas palatable.
But again, in any movement, you're going to have disagreement on the fringes, on the edges.
Well, I'm talking about Richard Spencer and Jared Taylor.
Okay, then you need to talk to Richard Spencer and Jared Taylor.
My point is that those are indisputably the two of the leading figures in this thing we're calling the alt-right. Correct?
Sure. Yes.
Okay, and they're also two of the major intellectuals informing the alt-right movement, correct?
I think
their ideas are especially prominent among.
I think Richard Spencer is much more prominent among the press.
He's an intellectual.
My point is, I think Jared Taylor is doing a lot more of the heavy lifting in terms of giving the intellectual background for this whole scene, because he's been on top of this for a very long time.
And he actually writes books, unlike Spencer.
No, Spencer has a Radix. He's got a couple of books.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I take it back. Well, see, I was right. Okay. So you think it's just strategic?
I think it's a mix, just like any. I mean, that I don't. You're asking these like really obvious questions that you know how in any political movement it's going to be this mix of things.
No, but it hasn't been for racist movements of the past. They, as I said, they were very careful, rigorous, and strict.
And some
because
weren't.
You have to be the whole.
And some used code, and some weren't.
But the whole premise of the project requires it, right? If race is the determinative thing,
require it.
But if one,
I really thought this said racial tissues. I just glanced at it. He has facial tissues next to me. I literally glanced at the corner of my eye. That said racial tissues. I'm like, that's pretty clever. And they're all white.
And they're all white.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And clean, and no Negro dialect unless they want one. Was that Joe Biden or Mitch McConnell or Harry Reid who said that? Here's the thing. Here's where you and I differ.
There's something important here.
Here's the thing.
And you're not allowing me to even make the point.
Here's the difference.
And I think you agree with me, but for some reason you're just resisting.
Here's the big difference between us and this.
Okay.
You are seeing this whole movement through race. You find that the most salient thing.
So were they.
Can I? Thank you.
No, blow your nose.
My nose is fine.
While I talk.
Okay. Are you a nose patrol like the Nazis tell me they are? You think race is the most salient issue in this whole thing. I completely, meaning you're focusing on the alt-right. Mm-hmm. I think it is not at all the most salient issue in this whole thing.
To them? Sorry.
I'm going to keep trying this until I get my thought out.
Okay.
You think, and I know how to talk in sound bites. I do. Okay. I always see Man TV being pretty.
Okay.
You think race is the most salient issue in this whole thing. I think what is by far the most salient issue is the analysis of progressivism. And what unites all the subsets is how they look at progressivism and how cultures are moved. So what is most interesting to you and is what's interesting to Richard Spencer is mm-hmm. not at all most interesting to me or the focus of the book.
Okay. So I think that is very smart. I think it is very interesting. I think it's more interesting, actually, than the analysis I was putting forward. I think it is plausible. I also am pretty sure they would disagree with you.
Correct.
Oh, okay.
I do not agree with Richard Spencer.
So you're saying
newsflash.
So that they are no, about what their own project is and what their own motivations are. And
who's
what,
they?
Spencer and Taylor and the alt-right.
Correct. I don't agree with
you
them. I'm not alt-right.
No. It's the analysis of what they think, right? Their ideas, their ideology. You're saying it's about progressivism.
For the fifth time,
oh my God.
The alt-right is a subset of this whole scene. So yes, this is the most important thing by far for the alt-right, but the alt-right are not at all the major focus of this book or what I find interesting about this subculture.
Okay, so let's, fine. Let's expand the scope and maybe this will become more clear now.
And another thing is I find it very interesting how much the media wants to fixate on the mm-hmm. Richard Spencers.
Right.
And for obvious reasons and for not obvious reasons
okay.
and for unintentional reasons.
Okay, great. Okay, so it sounds like one of the things you're doing with this book is trying to give a broader, more
broader
and coherent understanding of this thing and that the media is focused, has this myopic view of it, and they focus on these three or four guys
yes.
and a handful of people
correct.
Who are actually way less significant than this thing.
That, and way less interesting.
This other thing that's actually out there that you're calling the new right.
And way less innovative, correct.
Okay. So what is the new right then, according to Michael Malice?
So according to, I don't think anyone in the new right would disagree with this at all.
All right.
The new right is, and I think I said this on your last show, but let me repeat myself. It is a subset of subculture, which is united in their opposition to progressivism,
uh-huh.
which they regard okay. as a barely secularized
okay.
religion.
In which case I would be a member of the new right.
Correct.
Huh.
You're welcome.
What if I don't? What if I don't want to be a member?
Oh, okay. I mean, I don't know what to tell you.
Okay. So define it again. Give the definition of new right now. You just did, but say it again.
Sure.
Restate it.
The new right is a subculture united in their opposition to progressivism,
okay.
which they regard as a barely secularized religion with global hegemony as the goal, which demands complete socio-political control based on their ethics of egalitarianism, and there's some other thing in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I do belong to that.
Well, if you're not an active member, then maybe you're not a member. Do you know what I mean?
Like, I mean,
just because you agree with the thinking doesn't mean you're involved
in the scene. I am in line with
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I think those things. Yeah, for sure.
100%.
Obviously.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm just trying to think about who that puts me in the company with. Is there anyone I wouldn't want to be in the company with? Well, lots of people like
yeah.
Spencer and Jared Taylor. So that includes. Let's see. Yeah, who does this include besides? So we know the racist alt-right guys are in there.
Sure.
But you're saying they're a minor relatively small part of this.
They're minor.
Formation, which you're calling the new right. So who else is there?
They're minor in terms. They're not minor, but they're getting disproportionate attention, and I don't find them as interesting as the other. I don't find them as innovative. Is more importantly
innovative
because a lot of these ideas have been heard, as you said, for decades. Mm-hmm. The race and IQ is not a new. Right. Maybe it's new to most people that they haven't heard it, but this is hardly mm-hmm. revelatory to people who have studied race.
Right.
So a lot
before
of this,
I forget, yeah. Sorry, the mold bug,
yeah,
that thing, NRX, Cathedral, all that stuff.
Knee reaction, yeah.
Their argument is that it's a social construction, that progressivism is a social construct.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, which I like.
I know they would use that term, but yeah.
So that's where they are similar to Foucault and relativism and postmodernism and me. But what I find interesting and odd in a way is that from that, they move to what they call themselves reactionary politics. Aren't they sort of...
I think it's an ironic use of
nostalgic
the word
reactionary. For whatever, something?
No, it's more
medieval
an ironic...
feudalism or something? Like, what do they want?
I think it's more recognition that all human interactions are going to be inevitably hierarchical, for one.
Okay, so that's Jordan Peterson's thing, is hierarchy, like, based in the Bible, you know, based in basically... classical and medieval European societies.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't base it on that. I would say very term pecking.
Not you.
This is where I disagree with Jordan Peterson.
Moldbug. Moldbug's position. Does he want to return to
Moldbug,
hierarchical societies of antiquity?
Moldbug's position is that hierarchical societies, and this is that book, The Machiavellians, hierarchical societies are inevitable. And that any of these claims that we're going to have some kind of egalitarianism always results in far more oppression. So in this scene, you're also going to have people like Buchanan mm-hmm. and Murray Rothbard are the progenitors, Jim Goad, Gavin Coulter is in this scene.
Really?
Yeah.
She says she goes that deep. She talks about hierarchies being inevitable.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, when you talk about some cultures are superior to others, that's hierarchical.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Which is, so Coulter's gone in this direction very heavily. She interacts with a lot of these people on Twitter.
Okay. Okay. But so Moldbug and NRX, those guys, are they nostalgic about prior societies?
I think about certain aspects. Wouldn't use that term because it sounds
like. Yeah, I shouldn't have used that term.
It sounds like
that was a leading question.
Yeah.
Do they find older societies to be models?
No, I think what they would say is you have to look at all societies and pick and choose what works and what doesn't, and what's universal to human nature.
Mm-hmm. Because there's hierarchies all over the place, right? There's hierarchies in among the tribes in the bush in Papua New Guinea. They have
yes.
a hierarchy.
Yes.
Right? It just happens to be matrilineal or what's the other one?
Matriarchal?
Matriarchal,
it's
yes.
not matriarchal. There's no
matriarchal. Some are. Some
no,
are.
There's no matriarchal.
Excuse
there's a
me?
Book called Why Men Rule.
Oh, is that, who's this? The Margaret Mead critic?
I don't.
What's his name?
I don't. You can look it up. I'm blanking on it.
There's a debate about some guy came along who attacked Margaret Mead for making these claims about the South Pacific Islands. And I don't know. I haven't gone into it deeply enough to really speak intelligently on it. But I haven't seen clear evidence to refute that. That there, I think it's pretty clear that there are more or less matriarchal societies.
I disagree.
You're sure that there are none?
I'm not sure.
Oh, okay.
I'm just saying I disagree.
Okay.
For example, Thatcher's England is not matriarchal.
Oh, no, of course not.
Right.
No. She was making claims about the South Pacific.
I'm just clarifying the listeners because that's an example that people bring up.
Sometimes. Oh, no, it's a patriarchy with a woman at the head of
yeah.
it. Yeah, that's all.
Because how many people sure. in the House of Commons were male? It was still like 90-something percent.
Right. If patriarchy is defined by rule by the traditionally masculine.
Or males, specifically
well,
males. Forget even masculine, just males. The number of males who were running the government in Thatcher's England was 90-something percent. It was something crazy.
Oh, yeah. Well, I to me, it's much more important your behavior, your culture, your assumptions, your attitudes, your ideas, which there are some that are traditionally masculine, right? That's more important than your genitals. So for Thatcher, the fact that she behaved, acted like a man traditionally defined, is much more important than her genitals. So she's, to me, a patriarch. So they're, I mean, to me, what are they going for? So, okay, Moldbug wants to create...
But here's the thing.
What?
Since they're all united by opposition, there is no what's our goal.
No, I know, but each piece here. So the Moldbug piece, what do they want to create? Or are they clear about it at all? What kind of society do they want to live in? A medieval society with knights and peasants or what?
I mean, they're all over the place.
Okay.
So you have a range from the anarchists, you have the techno-futurists, you have the ones who do want some kind of Giuliani kind of Law and Order state. I think a lot of them will be happy, like, let's burn it down and whatever happens next is going to be better anyway.
Really?
As long as their enemies are killed first.
So nihilists.
I wouldn't say that. More like, let's roll the dice.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You know, like, it's like, you know what? Like, this isn't working.
My guess is they are sort of like Marxists in this way, which is that they have a hell of a critique about present society, and they don't say a whole lot about the society they want to build. They're not very specific.
Or
about utopia.
It's very hard to get a consensus.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So you put an umbrella over a bunch of us. Those of us who, I like the way you put it. That was good. We are opponents of progressivism. We believe progressivism is
a barely secularized religion.
Barely secularized religion. You and I have both publicly many times, independently of each other, by the way, called progressivism secular Christianity.
I say progressivism is Christianity, mythology.
Right, yeah, yeah. There's a debate.
I'm much pithier than you.
There's a debate about who, which of us said it first, but we'll just leave that there.
What
for
do you
now.
Mean? I had the quote, but you came. I'll give you credit if you came to it first.
I can't prove it. I think okay. I said it not on the record. I'll give you credit too. Okay. For now. Yeah. So yeah, secularized Christianity, that it is seeks global hegemony.
Yeah.
And equality is its.
Oh, and also I forgot how it works, which is it.
Egalitarianism is its central principle.
And also the idea that it is promulgated via the education system out through the media, which is trained thereof and implemented finally by the state.
Oh, and yes. And
those are the three stools, chairs and legs of the stool.
Yes. And that this is the moral framework in which even conservatives operate.
Correct. Yes.
So-called conservatives even operate. Yes. So we agree totally on all of that.
Yes.
Okay. As do Jared Taylor and Richard Spencer and Jim Goad and Gavin McInnes and Ann Coulter, I guess.
Jim.
No, Ann Coulter's a progressive. She wants to. No, she's an imperialist. What was her big line about the Middle East? We should invade them and convert them to Christianity.
That was like 15 years ago.
Oh, is she really no longer a universalist globalist?
I would bet she isn't.
I don't know about that. Okay.
I would bet. So, and Jim Goad also likes to be prickly and is like, I'm not going to be a member of any movement. It's like, nice try, Jim Goad.
Well, I mean, I don't. Okay, fine. So who else is in there?
That's the whole thing. My editor is so much in like, who are the leaders in this? And it's like, that's not how this works. This is much more like Al-Qaeda in its structure, where you have independent cells operating independently, which is why so many on the left think it's like Russian bots or AstroTurf. It's like, no, a lot of kids. You know that Trump, I just saw this on Twitter in the last couple of days. Trump would have won, I think, 45 states if he just polled white high school students. Which is insane.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. High school students, which almost always was left.
I would have thought Bernie would have won that.
No, Trump versus Hillary.
Oh, just okay. Yeah.
I was just like shocked to see that.
But if it were Trump versus Bernie.
I don't know.
I don't think
they ran that. But
okay.
Yeah.
But Trump. Yeah. Wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, so, okay. What about libertarians? Do you put them in there?
I don't really. I mean, like, what you mean? Like Libertarian Party?
You tell me. Like any so-called libertarian, self-identified libertarians, right? Are they part of the new right or not?
There's some that are, some that aren't.
Because
there's some libertarians who identify in some way as progressive.
Okay, for instance?
Like all the left libertarians.
You would put them in the new right?
I would put them in the garbage. Or in a wood chipper.
I've been called a left libertarian.
You're not a left libertarian.
I'm not?
No.
Why not?
Because you're not interested in policing speech.
Hmm. Oh, those left libertarians.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. What about...
Why are you sighing?
It's funny. What about, well, I take it the Mises Institute people, Lou Rockwell, the Rothbardians you would put in the new right?
Correct. So I start with where this union starts is Buchanan and Rothbard.
Okay. So the paleoconservatives.
And paleolibertarians.
And the paleolibertarians.
Yeah. This is where it broke into the popular consciousness, which was the 92 presidential campaign. Buchanan and Rothbard teamed up.
Okay, is that when Buchanan gave the culture wars
Correct.
Speech? Yeah, okay.
That's how to start the book.
Well, everyone should read that speech, by the way.
Yeah.
And scary.
And Andrew Cuomo, Mario Cuomo, excuse me, compared him to Hitler.
So let me tell you, that speech, not just that speech started it, but also I read his book on immigration. What's the name of it? It's like the end of
Suicide of the West.
Suicide of the West, there it is. It's racist. Which I don't care. That's fine. It's just that I decided early on, because he actually put one of my anti-war articles. I forget which one, but I wrote some article criticizing U.S. foreign policy. He put it on the front of his website, Pat Buchanan did, once. And I was like, yeah, I didn't say this to him. And I didn't ask for him to take it down. But I was like, yeah, I'm never going to be in a coalition of any kind with you, even if it's against the war. I'm just not going to line up with you. I'm not going to be considered part of your ideology in any way. So, Michael, I'm saying, I don't know, like, if I like this. I'm not, well, it's not that I don't like it. I don't care about that. I'm not sure. I'm just not sure. I'm thinking through this. I really don't know whether it's intellectually,
to be fair,
useful.
Okay.
Useful. Maybe it is to join, to group us all together.
It's not useful in the sense that good taxonomy is based on identifying what something is, mm-hmm. whereas this is identifying itself by something it is not. So it's like, if I'm going to describe an elephant and I sit down, it's not a tiger, it's not a seal, it's not, you know, a rhino, you're still not telling it what an elephant is. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing, is this umbrella does not have a strong united identity. It just has a strong united opposition, and they would all agree with that as well.
Okay. Okay. What do you want us to do with this information?
Do what thou wilt. I mean, I'm being glib, but it's true. I am not someone, as an anarchist, who's big on telling people.
Well, what's your purpose in writing the book?
As I said before, someone was going to write it. I figured it might as well be me. I know this scene. I've been swimming in it for quite a long time.
Right.
And I thought it would be useful for someone to also make this worldview kind of coherent and give it the justice that it deserves. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's there's so many attempts, intentionally and otherwise, to be dismissive and contemptuous of this whole world.
Mm, I just remembered why I really don't like your book.
Okay.
That hasn't been published yet.
Yeah.
No, it's really the title.
Okay.
The term you're using.
Yeah.
Which is right. I don't like that one. And I think it's incorrect.
I have a chapter on this, but let's go ahead.
Okay, it's incorrect. So historically, every political party, political movement, regime that I can think of in history that's been associated with the right,
uh-huh.
or has been called right wing,
right,
is statist, is
Rothbard, Rand,
militaristic.
Ayn Rand was the archpriestess of the acute right, they called her.
Well, a lot of libertarians don't call themselves right wing either. Most libertarians do not call themselves right wing.
The Libertarian Party, when it founded, regarded itself as right wing.
Okay, so you know, right, that most libertarians today say, I'm neither left nor right.
But that's like being an agnostic. That's being too much of a pussy to pick one or the other.
That's you forcing them into a category.
No, that's
that
logic.
Because
you don't have any, there's nowhere else to go but the graph.
Okay, fine. How about if I give you Ayn Rand, Murray Rothbard, and the Libertarian Party of the United States, okay, and say, sure, they've been associated with the right. I dispute even that, but let's say that's true. Now, then you got to give me the Nazis, Italian fascism.
Those are left wing, you're saying?
No, this is right.
Those are right wing.
Historically associated with the right. 100%. Now, how are they in any way similar to me or even Gavin McInnes?
Sure, easily.
Or
even the recognition that hierarchical is essential, inevitable.
Oh, that's not my thing. I don't make that argument.
You don't deny it.
Inevitable? What does that mean?
I don't know how to answer that question because I'm sure you know that term.
It's like biologically determined.
Inevitable just means it happens all the time in every situation.
You mean it has happened?
No, it does happen.
So those are two different claims, right? You can claim that things have happened in the past, make a claim about the future.
Sure. My claim is if something has happened in every human society throughout time, that this is something that is inevitable. Yes, I'm comfortable making that claim.
Okay. Can I think of a society in human history that was non-hierarchical? No.
But can you think of a society in animals that is non-hierarchical? The answer is no.
I think biologists have said some species.
Who knows? Even schools of fish have a hierarchy.
It all depends on definitions.
But it does not.
But let's stick with human beings.
It does not. And here's, they're not sticking with human beings because if something's happening even on an animal level, it's even more universal.
Okay. Now, let me maybe complicate matters for you.
Sure.
So I'll give you that. I just said it. I can't think of a society in which there wasn't an identifiable hierarchy.
Right.
Social hierarchy.
And I'll just say one more thing that's important.
Uh-huh.
To be on the right, it's to valorize this hierarchy.
There's a hierarchy in every relationship. like there's a hierarchy right here.
Sure.
Like I'm obviously your dad.
Sure.
In this relationship.
Yeah. Is that why I'm so turned on by you?
It's funny that daddy is a thing that they say, right? The alt-right people. I know Milo
does, but I told him to call his book.
That's like, that's the gay alt-right wing, or that's
he's not alt-right. I told him
light, right? Light, whatever. Alt-light.
Yeah. I don't like that. So I told him to call his book Daddy Issues. And in retrospect with all that pedophile stuff, I'm glad he didn't take my advice.
Right. So anyway, you agree with that, right? That there's a hierarchy in every relation between people, even between two people.
Correct. But that hierarchy might be fluid.
Sure.
Contextual.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, yeah. Good. See, this is my point though. See, you're being a postmodernist. I love it.
Sure. Whatever you like.
So I think you would also agree that the kinds of hierarchies there have been is nearly infinite. The hierarchies, there's been infinite kinds of hierarchies.
What do you mean by
in
that?
Human societies?
They're like feudalism versus democracy.
All kinds, right?
Oh, sure, sure.
Yeah, well, okay, yeah. So feudalism, democracy,
but
slavery.
But one of the essential differences between right and left is
anarchist communes, even those are hierarchical.
Of course, very
I agree.
Much. The charismatic leaders, yeah.
I agree. Even those are hierarchical and have been hippie communes.
Sure.
Sure, but they're different. They're a different kind of hierarchy.
Absolutely. But my point is, the difference between right and left is, are these hierarchies things that are admired and promoted, or are they something that, like, this is a problem and we should pretend they don't exist? Like income inequality,
for example. I don't like either of those. I don't want to celebrate or promote them or say they don't exist. I just think, yeah, they have certainly tended to exist. They exist in my life all around me.
But that's because you're so scared of making any kind of claims.
Multiple kinds of hierarchies.
Are you comfortable making any moral claims at all?
No.
So who's the nihilist here?
Dude.
I know. I'm calling you out on it.
I call myself out on it. What do you mean? This is my, like, I put a billboard over my head that says, amoral.
For a good time.
Amoral. For a good amoral time, call Thad.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. No. No moral claims. But this is not morality we're talking about. We're talking about...
this is more... I regard this as a moral issue.
Well, there's two questions. Okay. There's an epistemological or empirical question, which is, have there been hierarchies in human societies?
Sure.
And... that's one question. Second is, are they inevitable? Do they grow out of nature? Is it a natural thing?
Right.
Okay, that's the second question. Third question is, are they morally good?
Right.
Okay. I haven't gotten to the moral question yet. Okay.
Okay.
I'm simply calling into question this category of hierarchy. When you apply it in this way, it becomes sort of like race, in that if there have been infinite kinds of hierarchies,
sure,
right? And as you said, they're fluid.
Yes.
They constantly change, just like race, you know, right? In our minds.
Sure.
And in fact.
No, I wouldn't say it the same, because like a relationship between like a boyfriend and girlfriend is going to be much more fluid than our ideas of race.
Okay. So if there have been infinite kinds of hierarchies.
Sure.
An infinite number, then how useful is that concept?
Very. Because then you have infinite data points, which kind of basically proves the point.
Okay. So I'm gathering, tell me if I'm wrong, that a lot of this acceptance or promotion of hierarchy on the new right is...
And on right wing in general.
Is in part a repudiation of Rousseau's egalitarianism. Right?
10,000% true in defiance of mathematics. Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. He's the villain.
Yeah. 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 Everyone should read Rousseau immediately today. You'll see almost every bad thing,
yes,
in modern history comes right out of that,
yeah,
book.
Yeah, he is the villain.
The social contract.
Rand was wrong. It's not Kant, it's Rousseau.
The social contract is the root of everything. I've taught that book for many years now, and every time I really try to come at it with an open mind. Each semester I teach it, and by the end of the semester, not even then, but certainly by the end of the semester, I say to my students, like, because they see the same thing I do, I'm like, guys, isn't this like really the root of all of the worst stuff in,
yes,
modern history? And they say,
oh, yes,
yeah, I don't see any way around it. But then go ask a professor... another professor besides me, like even Rousseau scholars, political theorists who teach at Harvard and Berkeley, and they think it's good. Rousseau,
yes,
is
the villain.
Rousseau to them, though, is the basis
an
of what all that is good.
Yes.
It may have been perverted, and you know, there have been some bad decisions using that text, like, you know, Stalinist Soviet Union and Mao's China and all the rest of it. But it's amazing to me that they don't see what I see. It just is straight up totalitarianism.
Yes, beyond.
And at the base of it, the basis of his argument is this egalitarianism.
Yes. And also the idea that our nature is, like, I know, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because obviously I'm not a Rousseau scholar, but his point is, when we've given up being the savage and moved into the cities, we lost something. And I think he makes the argument, yeah, it's a good thing that we lost it, but we still, like, right. he's also an ascribe saying we should have done it. He goes, no, no, we should have done it, but right. it was still at a cost. So this idea that any progress is essentially tainted by its nature is really a pernicious, fucked up idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people misread his stuff on nature, the state of nature. He doesn't like the state of nature.
Right.
He says it's bad and it sucks to be in yeah. the state of nature. And what historically, this is according to him, has happened is, you know, people are naked and shivering out in nature by themselves, and they join together to save themselves from the state of nature. They can build stuff together. They can build homes and plant crops and all that stuff. But then from there, the turn for him is private property.
Yeah.
The invention of the concept and then the fact of private property
yeah.
As law. And that for him is the origin of inequality. And then from there, we've developed, according to him, things like slavery and monarchy and dictatorships and all the rest of it. So yes, egalitarianism, at least in Rousseau's mind, which is everyone agrees that Rousseau is in fact the major influence of all the modern left-wing movements.
Yeah.
So on this, we all agree.
Yeah.
We all agree. Even those who are pro-Rousseau and left-wing will say, oh yeah, Rousseau is the basis, the ideological basis of Marxism, of modern communism, of modern socialism, and much of what's called modern anarchism, the left anarchism.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And egalitarianism is at the heart of all of it, for sure. And what has that resulted in? And here's where you and me and everybody in your book.
Genocide.
Yeah. The deaths of hundreds of millions of people.
Yeah, you put the people in the meat grinder.
Among other bad things. You know, yeah. That's just one of the bad things. So, okay.
And here's the other thing. When I was a kid, I wanted to be a zookeeper. So I was very into zoology. Wow. Hold on a second.
That's so interesting.
So when I read these things and like Rousseau, it's like, if you had bothered to know anything about animals, you wouldn't be making half these claims. So right away, I would always regard them as insane and absurd in its face. For example, the idea that private property is something invented by people, whereas animals have their own home ranges that they mark off and defend their territories. This is very much somewhat of an equivalent. So the idea that it's unique to us is simply false. Hunting territories, things like that.
I wouldn't go there. But I mean, there's a concept and a legal construct and a set of laws.
Termites defend their homes.
That animals don't have, but that's okay. We don't have to go down that road. So here's the thing about Rousseau. Your claims, your arguments, and mine about progressivism and egalitarianism don't obviate his argument, and they don't make the Rousseauian project in any of its forms necessarily wrong or bad or misguided. Because as he says, if you get to the end of The Social Contract, his book, he says that there will inevitably be the need for a leader, a ruler.
Oh, yeah.
In the English translation in the States, it is a prince. And it looks a lot like a king all of a sudden. And people are like, well, what the hell is this? My students would say, what's this about? He's an egalitarian. Well, here's the thing. It's fine because the prince just does the will of the people, the general will. Right. So there's no need to worry about him.
Yeah, it's fine. It's going to be fine.
He's just doing the general will.
Yeah.
The general will.
That will be done.
Is the concept in Rousseau, yeah, right? There is this thing, this kind of ethereal thing. It's the general will that is just sort of, it is the spirit that encompasses and is the vehicle or the vehicle for, it's not even the people's wishes, because the people, he says himself, can be wrong.
Yeah, it's
Rousseau repeatedly says in that book, the people are often wrong. That's right. Why we need the prince to guide them back to the general will, which the general will is their interest. It's just that the people don't often know what is in their interest.
And the leader can intuit it better than they can.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Often. Yeah. He's just, I guess, he doesn't even explain this, but we assume that he means that the prince is simply just more in touch with or hasn't veered far from it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, and you see this with Obamacare was a good example of this being implemented.
So guess what emerges by the end of Rousseau's Social Contract? And guess what emerges at the end of every single left-wing movement in history that followed? A huge hierarchy.
Yeah.
The worst hierarchies, the most hierarchical societies ever.
Sure.
Right.
But like I said, there's a difference between saying hierarchy is inevitable and desirable and pretending it doesn't exist. Like, for example, under Stalin, you pretended everyone was equal.
Sure.
You know, it was not, even though it was the most or very close to the
most.
Is
that really true?
I mean, yes, it was very true.
Is that what you were taught? Well, you were too little.
No, I mean, this is what they told themselves with a straight face, and they had to have this double talk.
That was actually part of the official ideology.
Yeah, oh yeah.
That the Politburo was equal to the steel workers.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's
maybe.
It's whacked. mm-hmm. and that Stalin's just a guy doing his, you know, he's just smarter than us, but you know, it's this weird double talk.
Well, but the Marxist left has had this idea of the vanguard.
Yes, right? Correct. Yes.
And there's been arguments among the, on the left on this question, but most have basically, you know, agreed with this, that the people, the working class needs the vanguard.
Right.
Sounds like the prince. Sounds right. like a hierarchy. Right. Well, in fact, that's what it becomes.
Well, I think this was the big problem for Marx.
By the way, guess who the vanguard always is?
Who's ever saying that they're the vanguard?
Exactly.
Yeah. Ayn Rand always said, anyone who wants more power to the state is or wants to be the state.
Meaning it's professors.
Yeah.
Intellectuals. Basically.
Well, my understanding,
it has been.
My understanding is Marx's problem is he would sit down with these unions in Europe and be like, come on, let's overthrow the government. They're like, dude, we just want better working conditions.
Exactly.
What the fuck are you talking about?
We want to get higher wages. Yeah. What do you mean? What's a revolution? What's socialism?
And then he had to invent the whole idea of false consciousness, which is very Rousseauian, mm-hmm. which is your guys aren't in touch with the general will.
Marx, yeah, I'll say that. He did, more or less. He didn't use that term. That was really the Frankfurt School who really coined the term false consciousness, which is one of the worst ideas ever
yes.
of the left. And they've had a lot of bad ideas. I would say the roots of it are in Marx, though. That's fair to say. And certainly in Lenin.
You don't know what's good for you. And we do.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, of course. No, we agree. So that's it's called vanguardism. There are people on the left who are critical of
so
all that.
There's a Spartacist League, which is mm-hmm. a contemporary communist movement.
My secular godfather was a member of the Spartacist.
Isn't their newspaper called Vanguard?
He had a gun, and that was the first time I ever saw a gun.
Oh yeah.
And I was scared of it, and I recoiled when I saw it, and he said, oh, we all need guns. I said, you're for gun rights?
Oh yeah, the commies are good
and
with
guns. And he said, oh yeah, we need when the revolution comes, of course we're gonna need guns. And I was like, oh, ding.
And we're not gonna trust the cops.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, the cops are the enemy.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they're good on that one.
So a Rousseauian would say, I think, in response to you, sure.
What would a Rousseauian say to Jared Taylor? Let's just paraphrase people who aren't in the room.
You play Rousseau and I'll play Jared Taylor.
Okay.
What would be
the consequence
of the social contract?
You know, I was at Charlottesville, right?
Yeah, why were you?
Part of me wanted to speak because I was going to go up there.
What did you want to say?
I was going to go up there and say who my favorite drag race contestants were in no particular order.
Uh-huh. You're a big fan of RuPaul's Drag Race.
I've gotten a little bit over it now that it's become so mainstream.
After how many seasons? I mean, you've been a fan for a long time.
Since episode one. Yeah. And I picked the winner of season 9 before the season even started. And I told this to her face and she gave me credit for it, Sasha Velour. So
I tried to have Bianca Del Rio on this show and she gave me 20 minutes. She said, I'll do the interview, but 20 minutes. And I said, no.
I can get in. This is a very big sidebar.
Hook me up.
What was my point with this?
I don't know. Rousseau, Jared Taylor, egalitarian.
Oh, so I was at Charlottesville.
Oh, Charlottesville.
And
Drag Race. You were going to talk about the Drag Race.
That's what I was going
Drag Queens.
I was going to troll. I didn't realize it was going to be such a big thing.
Oh, okay.
As it ended up.
Oh, you were just going to troll them.
Oh, yeah.
The right wingers who were there.
They would have appreciated it.
Yeah. What were you going to say?
I told you, my speech would have been, here are my favorite Drag Race contestants in no particular order.
That's
why?
It.
That would have been my speech.
What do you think? How do you think they would have responded?
I think it would have been a mix between the people who fucking got it and were peeing their pants and the other ones who were just uncomfortable and angry.
Mm-hmm.
Because I honestly thought there'd be like 20 people in Charlottesville. I didn't realize.
Yeah, how many were there?
There were hundreds. And Antifa outnumbered them.
Of the right wing?
That march, there was a fuck ton of them the night before.
Like how many? Like how many hundreds?
I wasn't like 200?
I don't know.
I think it was some big number.
I'm asking.
I wasn't there the night before.
So if 200 is a big march for a movement, it's a very small movement.
I don't think that's accurate.
What do you mean?
Because I think 200 people, how many people are in the Senate?
Did you not see how many women marched on Washington the other day?
Yeah, but those are all part of the cathedral.
I know, but my point is we don't like that movement, but it's a major, it's a massive movement. It's a large movement. 200 people, if your movement produces 200 marchers, that's a small political movement by anybody's standards.
I don't think small is a germane term here because I think those people have a lot more intellectual ammunition than any of those women in that march.
On the face of it, that claim is absurd. What are you talking about? Those are the people who run the universities.
Right, but they have nothing original to say is my point because they run the universities.
Well, not. But they have, what'd you say? They're influential. They're certainly more influential.
I'm not saying they're not influential. I'm saying they have nothing original to say.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Okay. So
that's why I said they're ballast.
So here's what a Rousseauian would say.
Okay.
Back to the question.
Who would their favorite Drag Race contestant be?
They would. And they would say,
probably
BB
Zahara.
A Rousseauian would say, and this will not be a surprise to you. You've heard versions of this argument.
Sure.
They would say, yes, it's true that ever since Rousseau wrote that book, every political movement that's been inspired by it has resulted in a terrible hierarchy and many deaths that were quite unfortunate and we're very sad about them.
Right.
But hierarchies, which are counter to Rousseau's egalitarianism.
Right.
That's why we repudiate all these past mistakes,
right.
These mistaken applications of Rousseau's right. theories. Nonetheless, we believe that we should always move toward an egalitarian society. We may never get there
right.
to a perfectly egalitarian society,
right.
but we should always be moving toward
right.
treating
right.
everyone
it's a bait and switch.
As equals. Well, I think it's intellectually coherent and
it's not
principled and
it's neither.
Logical. Why not?
It's internally logical.
So, internally, yes. Okay.
So here's why it's a bait and switch. So the right-wing perspective is if you are setting up on a mission that you know inherently is impossible, you are setting yourself up for failure at the very, very least, but far more likely it's going to be extraordinarily counterproductive. That's number one. Number two is if I am promising, I remember this in college. I took a bioethics course with some dim-witted college professor. And this is when the Hillary Clinton healthcare was coming forward. And her whole point was that there is enough healthcare to go around and more people need access to healthcare, which is a valid perspective. So the answer to this is we have to ration healthcare from her own words.
Right. Huh?
So I said, okay, so you're saying because not enough people have healthcare, we have to mandate by law that not enough people will have healthcare. And she's like, basically like, yes. It's like, okay. And when at a certain point, when you're talking to someone, you just have to say, okay, and just nod. So they are setting themselves up saying, we will never have an egalitarian society. However, I can go in that direction. It's like, well, you're going in a direction that you will never achieve and by your own admission.
Well, no, I think her argument, wasn't it, that the scarcity of healthcare should be equally distributed.
Sure.
Yeah.
More equally.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying.
Right.
So that's
not equally, but you see, you did the switch she does. There's a difference between equally and then it becomes more equally. It's like, whoa, if we can't get all the way there, why is some better than none?
Because it's more equal.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah. That just means I like it.
If I have $1 and you have $5, if I take $1 away from you, we're not egalitarian, but it's more equal, isn't it? Wouldn't you agree with that?
No. 2 and 4 are not equal.
Oh, it's either pure equality or it's not equal at all.
It's inequality, correct.
The term itself is invalid.
It's mathematical.
Oh, I see. Oh, it's mathematical.
Yeah.
I see. There's either an equal sign or there isn't.
Correct.
But can't you move toward equality? Isn't there a movement toward and away?
To some extent,
from equality?
But I mean, it's still going
taking a dollar from you. Isn't that moving toward each of us having one?
That's assuming that you're going to be able to get to $2, $3 each.
But shouldn't we always be pushing toward what would be equal?
Why?
No. If we believe that
you
equality
should.
This is their mind,
sure.
Not mine. If we believe that equality is good, shouldn't we always be pushing toward that? So it is egalitarian to take a dollar from you.
It's in the egalitarian direction.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Well, so I think that's all fine. I mean, within its own logic, like that's coherent to me. That makes sense.
It's not coherent to me.
You have to value equality, though, which you and I don't.
I don't think it's coherent to set up a goal that you know is impossible.
Well, that you're assuming that they believe themselves that it's impossible. How do you know that?
I don't know. I don't. I agree with you.
Yeah.
I'm not speaking for them.
Yeah.
You're the one who likes speaking for other people.
No. We know, you know that a lot of leftists have totally believed in an egalitarian future, the possibility of it.
There's two kinds. So there's leftists, for example, let's talk about race and prejudice. There's plenty of people on the left who I'm friends with, have no problem with, who would say, yeah, you're always going to have the racist grandpa. I don't care. It's like, that's not a problem. Like, as long as, like, if you go up to work, you're not denied a job and you're racist. I'm like, you know what? I'm totally down with. Mm-hmm. Then there are the ones who are like, we're not sleeping until, you know, there's no races to be had. It's like, this is a religious perspective.
And there are no rich people too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you hear less of that than the race one, I think.
These days. But
yeah,
for a long
correct.
Time, that was they really hate the rich. And they're not going to sleep well until there are no rich people.
Correct.
No inequality.
Correct.
Inequality was the big word until like this year. I mean, that race took over recently because of Trump.
No, I think race is their creation myth. The civil rights myth.
I'm not arguing with you there. But you know that inequality was the big word for a while before the election. That's what everybody was worried about and cared about. So what I'm saying is that the new right claim that hierarchy is inevitable does not in itself invalidate egalitarian left-wing politics. because you can always move toward equality, even if we believe that it's not ever going to become one and one.
For the third time, that's why they say inevitable and desirable.
Right.
So this valorization of inequality and hierarchy is what makes it right wing, because conservatives are not that comfortable with, they agree that there's going to be hierarchy that's inevitable, but they don't love it.
So you valorize hierarchy?
Yes. So one of the big distinctions between right and left is, do you...
Why do you valorize hierarchy?
One of the big distinctions between right and left is, do you empathize with the weak or do you sympathize with the strong?
Right.
Like you had that quote from Gandhi, like the most important people is like how you judge, how you treat the lowest. Mm-hmm. As opposed to Rand, mm-hmm. whose entire Atlas Shrugged is the most important people are the people at the top.
Right. And as opposed to Nietzsche. So a lot of this comes from Nietzsche.
Sure.
Yeah. That's his whole thing.
Right.
He's talking about slave mentality.
Right.
Yeah, those who identify with the inferior, the oppressed are basically exhibiting a slave mentality.
Right.
I don't valorize hierarchy. I don't valorize those above me or that there are people above other people. I don't celebrate that or valorize that.
Yes, I think you do. Do you think that there's some people who are worthless talking to and then some who are awesome to talk to, right?
Who's speaking for whom?
You
know what happened just now? Our hierarchy got fluid.
Am I a woman now?
At the very end of the conversation. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Yeah, it sort of climaxed with that, you know, I'm just saying.
Well, I told you I was going to be gentle. Was it simultaneous? Was it as good for you as it was for me?
I don't know. I just feel really relaxed now. And
good.
I can't remember what we were talking about.
We were talking about saying you don't valorize hierarchy.
Yeah, no.
I'm actually listening to you.
And I think that's where I differ from these guys.
That's fair.
It's one of many ways in which I differ from them. I don't valorize hierarchy. I am pleased to accept it in many cases because I don't want to be the mayor of New York City.
Fair.
I don't want to decide who takes out the trash. I don't want to be the guy who decides who gets shot by the cops and who goes into the cages. And I don't want to be the one to decide
the politicians
where we drop the bombs and the leaders.
No, the politicians are the ones who are going to get shot.
I also don't want to be a CEO of a corporation. Yes, this is true. I'm a CEO of a corporation of one person. So far.
You have an assistant.
He's not an employee.
You have an assistant.
He's a consultant.
You have an assistant.
He's a contract consultant, but, okay, that's true. But that's as far as I want it to go. I mean, ideally...
I guess that just means you're bad at it.
Well, yeah. That's true. Okay. I think we're done here. Now it's just getting too fluid now. Yeah. And you're too uppity.
Uppity? That's a racial term. Are you saying that because of my Negro blood?
You're black, of course.
Yeah. You have curlier hair than me.
Oh, boy.
A wavier.
Well, Michael Malice, it was good to talk to you. Thanks for coming by the show.
We're really going to end it with that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm done with you.
You are?
I think we covered it all.
I don't think we did, but that's okay.
What are we missing?
I mean, I think this stuff is so often hair-splitty, mm-hmm. and there's so many different perspectives. It's very hard for... It's as you, someone who's kind of more fluid in vis-a-vis truth...
There's that term again.
For me to sit here and be like, this is what they think about this.
That's fine. No, I feel good. I feel like I got my positions out there, my interpretations, and I think you heard them. Yeah. Honestly, I do. And I think your book will have a different title.
It won't.
Yeah, well.
It's going to be called A Renegade History of the Right.
Oh, Jesus Christ. That's when I kill you.
Do you know how many copies?
That's when shit gets really real.
How many copies did you sell, do you know?
Of my book?
Yeah.
I actually honestly haven't checked.
Yeah, they don't tell you.
We don't. Well, you can find out. You can find out.
When, I know, but I thought you meant...
With your St. Martin's, Macmillan?
Yeah, St. Martin's.
I don't know about them, but they probably will have a way for you to know.
Oh, I know. I'm just... It's
why?
Just,
it, why?
I'm just saying... I'm just curious. It's funny for the audience because people think that if you're an author, off the top of your head, you know how many copies of your book you've sold, and that's completely inaccurate.
Oh, even the reports they give you are not super precise.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like podcast downloads. We have a rough idea of how many, but as you know, like people download the same show more than once. And so we count those people twice.
Oh, I did not know that.
Well, that's the problem that the industry is dealing with. Why are we talking about this? You have to go.
Okay. I thought it was interesting.
No, you got to get out of here.
Okay.
I told you.
Is it four?
There's a deadline for you.
Yeah.
Other guests, I just let talk as long as they want. But
Are you starting your dominance?
Among me and my employees, it's just known as the malice rule.
Good.
That's all.
That's going to give it some cred.
So we're done here.
Then it looks like it's true.
Michael, good luck out there.
Thank you, Thad.
Bye.
This was the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To sign up for the Renegade University webinars, visit thaddeusrussell.com/courses. To support the show and become a member of the Unregistered community, go to unregisteredlisteners.com. Thanks for listening.